The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio. Keep your mission on your mind, and your mind on your mission. This is Mission Minded with Michael Coleman.
Welcome back to a Mission Minded. Keep your mind, your mission, your mission, your mind. He is Michael Coleman, my good friend, CEO of the Heart of Alabama Food Bank. We do a show every single week called Mission Minded. We follow it up with Bite by Bite. And as always, not only do I love doing the show because it's important for business people, but it's important that my friendship with Michael Coleman grows through this show, and it does every single week. Michael, how you doing, brother? Everything good?
I'm doing great. How's your week been?
Everything's been fantastic. It's finally cooled off. We're gonna go. We're hitting the pumpkin patch tomorrow, and my son's coming in from Clemson. So it is all good. I'm super blessed. Yeah. It's gonna be great. Speaking of getting out, Jane Goodall, and it's funny because a lot of people, as soon as you think of Jane Goodall, well, you think of monkeys, you think of chimpanzees for obvious reasons, gorillas in the mist or whatever. But there was a really good article, the five things that Jane Goodall taught us about business. I want to get into on the show today that I think is going to be really entertaining and fun. So we'll stretch your legs here in just a second. We have gotten a ton of emails though. Info@TonyCurryRadio.net, info@TonyCurryRadio.net. Of course, you could also always hashtag us at HAFB wherever you write or leave us emails. Make sure you hashtag HAFB so we get all those things. But a lot of people are concerned about you and your organization because of the government shutdown. And I hadn't even thought of that, quite frankly. I know that Trump cut you back quite a bit earlier in the year, and because you are who you are, you make up those differences. You tackled it head on. You figured that out. But what exactly is happening on with the government shutdown, and how does that affect not only Heart of Alabama Food Bank, but also Feeding America?
It's not right for us in particular with how the government relates to us, because we only get about 25% of our funding from the government. And 30% of our food. So the way it works is we're very fortunate in that they had already allocated those funds, and that food had already been sent down to the states from the federal government. So from that perspective, I don't think we're going to be impacted heavily in terms of being able to get food. I think through the end of the calendar year on that side, we're good. Where we'll see an impact is if people are having to go to work or out of work and they're not getting paid. Yeah. And you know, the old adage is so true that, you know, almost half of Americans are one paycheck away from, you know, standing in a food line. And so what will begin to happen is we'll start to get some calls. Our agencies will say, hey, they're seeing their numbers come up. Which means they need more food, more quantities of food to make up that difference. There was already going to be some of that. And we've talked about it in previous shows a little bit about the SNAP benefits that are cut. And the truth of the matter is you hear two different sides. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. But a lot of what they cut in terms of SNAP benefits are things that money that was not necessarily being used as it should be.
Okay.
So some of that being reduced won't have a direct impact, but anytime you're trying to reduce waste, you're trying to reduce fraud, all of that kind of stuff, inevitably you're going to hit people who it will impact. So we do anticipate an increase, but that was already kind of built in with the big, beautiful bill. And, you know, I have such mixed emotions about it. My heart just goes out to people. But, you know, I've seen, if you spend any time on social media, you see reels. And, of course, I can't even tell now with AI and stuff what's real and what's not. Yeah, it's very confusing. But, you know, you'll see a mom that goes, hey, I was getting $1,000 a month for my three kids. And now it's been cut to $210. What am I supposed to do? And so you kind of get this range of people who are genuinely wrestling with it. You have others that have this kind of entitled approach. Hey, I have It's the government's responsibility. It's the taxpayer's responsibility to help me take care of my family.
Yeah.
And that kind of builds resentment and all of that. But I think the vast majority of people are, these are my children. This is my family. And they're doing everything they can. And so they will be impacted. And so we're really trying to prepare and think through that and really have already thought through it. They're just doing our best in terms of food quantities and things like that to be able to respond effectively.
Much like, and we've gone through these numbers, like 1 in 5, I've seen this story, 1 in 5 children that go to public schools are hungry, which is just hard to believe. And now would be the good time to be the neighbor, to be the good friend, to be whatever you are, the steward, and reach out to people that perhaps are in government positions, or maybe they do work for the TSA or whatever, and just say, hey, look, can I help you out? Because anything that you can do for them, and a lot of people are too damn proud to ask, and this won't do it. I did want to ask you, though, before we get into the Jane Goodall thing, because I got to be honest with you, the whole idea of working and not getting paid to me just does not seem right to me. And I understand I can't believe we actually have a law that not only says that you must continue to work, but now they're trying to find some type of loophole that says that they may not even get their back pay. Can you just talk about, you've been working your ass off your entire life. You gave your service to your country. What are your thoughts on that? And I let people like, well, you know, you take pride in your job. You know, you're in safety. Yeah. A lot of people place firefighters, school teachers, and even TSA people above everyone else because it is more than a job. It is a public service, and you're right. Expected. You're not allowed to march in front of a school if you're a school teacher, because damn it, that's what you do. Right. And you're here for the better cause of America, blah, blah, blah. But damn it, if you're not getting paid, I got a problem with that. Can you talk a little bit from your heart what that's like? And, mm-hmm. and if the Heart of Alabama came to you, so listen, Michael, and we actually had it during COVID, in our radio business, they came to us, and because no one was open in advertising, they asked us to take a 15% pay cut across the board. Everybody. Yeah. And I was like, wow. And it was for a certain period of time. And then we would get our money back. And then we were told that, we weren't going to get in arrears. We were just going to give up that 15%. We realized how lucky I was. I was like, I'll give up 30% to continue to talk for a living. I know how damn blessed and lucky I was. But can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So here's my, and somebody could easily point out an exception. I think this is what it is. I think the law is written. So, it goes, the first I ever remember hearing about this was, back during the Reagan years, I was in high school, and he fired, I think it was in 82, he fired the air traffic controllers. It was a huge thing. I mean, he fired them all because they went on strike. And basically he said, I'm not going to allow you. I know that you have a union, but I'm not going to allow you to hold the safety of the country and use it as leverage mm-hmm. to get more money or to get whatever they were fighting for at the time. And so he told him, if you go on strike, I'm terminating you. And then, what a nightmare that was. Oof. I can only imagine. Well, so I think in this kind of situation where they go, okay, these things are necessary, transportation, air, all those things are absolutely essential. And I think the people who are against it are looking at it and saying, well, technically nothing's written in the law that you're going to get back pay. So then I think they throw that out there as a fear, as a tactic to try to pressure the other side. I will tell you, while I can't guarantee anything, I would be absolutely shocked if people worked and then when it's passed, that there's not back pay to cover their time. Now, that doesn't necessarily help them in the moment. If this thing goes on for 6 weeks, then you're like,
was the last in 35 days? I think it went 35 days the last time we had a shutdown.
Yeah. And so you put some people in some difficult positions, and it's not fair. And it's neither party look comes out of it smelling good, you know, because a lot of it is petty and, you know, it's all about power grabbing and all of that and leveraging each other. And there's people that get caught up in that. I just cannot, I have never personally heard, is it possible? Yes. But I've heard those threats before, and it, whenever it gets restored, they always pay them back.
Yeah.
So I think it's more of a worst case scenario scare tactic to try to pressure the other side into caving or to kind of bring some political heat on the other side. So, because you and I both look at that on the surface, we're saying you're absolutely critical. You have to work. And then when they turn the spigots back on, oh, well, I'm sorry. You just, that violates just our core ethics of fairness and what's right. And I think that applies to whichever side of
the
political.
By the way, are people in the House and Senate, are they still getting paid?
They are.
It would be
and a matter of fact, they put some people have put forward some legislation to try to cut their salaries.
Yeah.
To give them some incentives. Well, but they're still getting paid.
You'd see some shit happen real fast if all of a sudden that's it was hitting their pockets for sure. All right, we lost a wonderful woman, and it's unfortunate that it took the loss of her life for a lot of people to go delve back into her life and realize just how what of a special woman she was. Jane Goodall, of course, a lot of people remember from the Monkees and Gorillas in the Mist and everything. Five things that Jane Goodall taught us about business. And I wanted to go through these, and I'll certainly read along with you, but these are really good. First one is lead with curiosity, not assumptions. It goes on to say breakthroughs rarely come from rigid frameworks. Research from Harvard Business Schools show that curiosity improves decision-making, fosters creativity, and enhances collaboration. Organizations that encourage curiosity are better at adapting to uncertainty and uncovering new opportunities, while those that suppress it often miss critical signals of change. We'll start with there. What you got?
Yeah, when I think about that, leading with curiosity, of course, you're not going to list any sort of problem that I've not personally been guilty of that I can't relate to. I have come into situations, and it's interesting because when we encounter difficult people or we encounter difficult situations, and then we're like, okay, I'll just throw this out, for instance, somebody with this personality type. And you kind of sense it right away. And so then you kind of just fill in the rest of what a relationship will look like, mm-hmm. how difficult it'll be or how difficult change will be or whatever. And so once you start to experience things that you connect to past memories and past experiences, then we tend to just fill it in that we already know what's going to happen. And we fill in our experiences ahead of time with full of assumptions. Now, do those assumptions play out? Sometimes they do. But, you know, the old, assumptions, on the board, they make assumptions make an ass out of you and me, or if you assume that old thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I looked at that, when I was reading that article, one of the things about her that I think illustrates that is in the 60s when she went out, she didn't really have any scientific expertise. She was on the coattails of other people. She didn't have it, but she got so turned on to that life and so committed to researching, gorillas and chimpanzees and all of that. And so what she ended up doing was not because, she didn't come into it with all this knowledge and making all the assumptions. The science had already put forth things, and she sat back and was like, I'm gonna study this and be a part of this and not make assumptions, and so she ended up changing the world's view on chimpanzees. And you learned a lot about their behavior and silverback gorillas and all that kind of stuff that she brought to the world because she said, "I'm gonna step into this environment and I'm not bringing all the things that other people have said. I'm gonna bring it and I'm gonna experience it myself." And see and allow the circumstances to form my opinion rather than come in with preset. And I think on any new venture, whether it's a new relationship, whether it's a new job, a new stage in life, a new church, a new house, whatever it is. What a great example and a great lesson for all of us if we could just go in and allow the good. Because, you know, we make assumptions, that, especially on the negative side, that I'm going to do this, but I'm going to hate it. You already are creating barriers and obstacles to peace in your life, joy in your life. And then we get there and we're like, well, that's really not as bad as I thought. And that's happened probably to everybody that's listening.
That's a word that we don't use enough. The word curious, because it's always interesting. I always think about a child. Whenever someone says he's very curious about things, that's normally a really good thing. He's going to become a scientist. He likes to tinker with things. He needs to figure out why things. You know, I took my son, for example, my special needs boy, up to this pinball museum up in Roanoke, Virginia, several months ago. And it was $20, and it was every pinball machine you could imagine, from stuff that was made yesterday all the way stuff back in the 1800s. And it was free because you paid it $20. So I can't find him. I'm looking around. We're playing pinball for hours and hours and hours. And I go back, and he's got one of the machines. He's lifted the top, and it's up, and he's looking inside the thousands and thousands and thousands of wires and every little wire. And he's sitting there just looking at it. And you know, he's got special needs, so he visually he's impaired. And I said, what are you doing, buddy? And he was just amazed by, well, wait a minute, if this touches this, this light comes on here. He sat there and looked at it for like an hour and a half.
Yeah.
I said,
yeah,
you know, you can put that down and play the pinball machine if you want. He didn't care about playing the pinball machine. He wanted, he was curious on how it worked, which I thought was super cool. And he was happy. I was happy. Number two, courage over conformity. True leadership often requires defying short-term pressures to uphold long-term principles. Having courage means going beyond easy commitments to embrace bold, sometimes unpopular actions. I read this and you were like, you could be in the dictionary for it, because you, I've seen you do it with Jimmy Hell Mission. I've seen you do it with the Heart of Alabama Food Bank. You'll do it in your entire life. You've always thought outside the box. You've done what you have to do to be successful, but you're always willing to think outside the box and do some things that perhaps maybe even a board would not understand. And you've done that with a lot of success. Talk about that a little bit.
Because when I've looked at it, things, sometimes there are easy solutions, traditional solutions that are the best solutions. But sometimes when we have lingering problems, and we have these societal issues all the time, and it's I'll try to get through this real quick, but I think it illustrates it. I was talking to the mayor of Birmingham one time, and the question was, well, what would you do? He asked me the question, well, what would you do about the homeless situation? And they were looking at the time at tiny houses as a solution. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, Mr. Mayor, here's the thing. The traditional approach is, okay, people don't have a house, we need to get them in houses. I said, but that's really not the issue. The issue, the reason people are upset is because there's panhandling. If I set up an attorney's office, I don't want my clients to be hit up for money every time they come in and out. And so even if you put people, let's say you capture this huge space, huge parking lot, you put tons of tiny houses out there and they lived in them, and they walked out in the morning, they're still going to panhandle because there's other issues associated that with their life that, you know, they don't necessarily want to go in the workforce, or they want to stay on the street. They're in addiction, whatever it is. And I said, so what I think is, and I didn't come up with all this on my own. I listened to other people along the way, but I said, here's what I think is doable, and this politically viable as well. I said, you go pick everybody up that you see that's homeless, not to throw them in jail, but to give them a case manager and determine one thing. Do you want to come off the street? Because you'd be amazed how many people I talked to that said, no, I don't want to come off the street.
Yep.
Again, for a host of reasons. But if they want to come off the street, then at the Jimmy Hell Mission or some anywhere that, you know, I think, hey, we want to provide somebody a place to do that and a place to deal with their, if there's addiction or to deal with the emotional or the mental, whatever it is that's led them to be on the street. Because I've made this case many times. You're not going to drive around in Alabama and see a family of four who are living in their cars because there's no jobs.
Yeah.
You know, they want to go to work and they're not, you know, it's always something in the background. So I said, take the few that do want to come off the street and get them the treatment that they need. And then everybody else who says, no, I don't, then you determine where they're from. So, for instance, if they were from Houston, Texas, then instead of them living on the streets of panhandling Birmingham, you put them on a bus back to Houston, which you're sending them back closer to family.
Mm-hmm.
But my argument was, this is politically viable. Number one, it's going to be cheaper. You're going to weed out the homeless people who don't want to change, and you're going to put them in a location. It's actually more humane. Instead of leaving them on the streets of Birmingham, you're sending them back closer to family and even trying to maybe contact if they give you a point of contact of their nearest relative. So that is totally thinking about it differently and approaching it differently, because we get stuck in these patterns and these traditional thoughts, even though those aren't working. We are stuck in these constraints to step out of it. And she was a great example of thinking about the world differently.
Yeah. And I'll be honest with you, this show is something that a lot of people would not think to do. And we actually do two shows together because you thought outside the box and you listened to some ideas that we had. And we thought, hey, listen, we may have something here. And while everyone wants to advertise, obviously, to build up their group, whether it's a for-profit or non-for-profit, the branding aspect of what a show like this does, and good for you to think that forward in that. Think systems, not silos. This is certainly one of those ones I was like, ooh, this sounds good. Jane Goodall often reminded us that we are part of the natural world, not separate from it. We depend on it for clean air, water, food, and everything. In her advocacy, she warned that disturbing one part of a system inevitably destabilizes the whole. Her insistence on interconnection serves as a cause for leaders to adopt systems, tools that help them understand today's complex challenges. So the key takeaway is today's leadership requires systematic vision. A Forbes article argues that today's most crucial leadership skill is systems thinking, urging leaders to move beyond silos, test strategies and simulation, and respond to complexity with agility and insight. I have no clue what I just read, but you're a businessman, so it sounds really good. Please tell me what I just read and why it works.
Well, from my perspective, I will just say, imagine you have a company or you're running a company, and it has five different departments. And so if each department runs in a silo, in other words, doesn't consider, if marketing doesn't consider how what they're doing is affecting operations, and operations is not affecting, in our world, partner services, everybody's operating in silos.
Gotcha.
But who is overseeing it to make sure that there's a synergistic effort? Because what we have found is all it takes is when the communication stops. I'll give you just another great example. Just yesterday, we gathered around the table. We got a call. There's a professional football player who is from Montgomery, and he plays with the Washington Commanders. And he's coming home in the off week around Thanksgiving and wanted to distribute some turkeys.
Oh, wow, great.
Yeah. So, but his agent called one person. Then he reached out to another partner agency of ours, but then he called one of our staff members, and then somebody else, a friend of the guy's mother, called. So, and then the guy, so we had four different conversations going. And when I heard that, I'm like, time out, everybody come to the table. It's going to go through one person, because all we were doing is fixing to create a mass misinformation campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this department was telling this person one thing, this department. So we had to see how it was affecting the operations, that the information comes in here and then it gets doled out to what the needs are. But it's that you have to think about it holistically as an entire system, what you do, and understand, because things could be really good for one department. But if it hurts another department by enacting something good, then you have to weigh that out. You have to consider those things. Inside of a department, they tend to look in silos. Mm-hmm. Leaders don't tend to look in silos because they realize they have a bigger picture. But if you have a department head, they typically don't think through how it affects the other departments. They're like, this is what we think is best to do, and this is how we want to move forward. Oh. So leaders have to step back and see how actions affect. You could even take it into a personal thing and say it's a family dynamic. A parent looks at all the kids who want to do what they want to do. They're about serving their needs, their interests, and you make decisions to not allow or to allow something, lots of times considering how it affects the family dynamic.
No, and I thought that was interesting too, because obviously we're talking about Feeding America and the Heart of Alabama Food Bank, and we're actually mentioning silos. So I thought that was just a perfect fit for something. Here. Number four, build trust through empathy. Empathy sometimes is viewed as a weakness. Research shows otherwise. Studies highlight a significant link between empathetic leadership and innovation. 61% of employees with highly empathetic senior leaders report being innovative at work, compared with only 13% of those with less empathetic leaders. This is something that we've been talking about just based on what you do for a living pretty much your entire time you've been there.
You know, when I tell people like we hired a new director recently and kind of scared her because I tell her the same thing I tell everybody is, hey, we move incredibly fast. No, we don't move recklessly, but we don't get into this paralysis through analysis. We know where we're trying to go and we make quick judgments about this is how we want to do it, move forward. And we don't get into all this hand wringing and all that. We do a risk assessment. We choose where we're going and we begin to go with it. And so people are moving along at different paces. And lots of times if you detach what's going on in somebody's life and you're like, I just demand performance. I demand performance. There's this weight that stays on everybody's shoulders versus empathy says, I'm going to allow me as a human to sit down with you, especially if you're not performing up to standard or especially if you're having some challenges, and say, right now in this moment, I'm going to care more about your needs than the needs of the organization. And so I want to hear what's going on with you because right now I will never get the best out of you if we don't resolve this issue. And not that I resolve it, but lots of times just being there and projecting the fact that I care, like right now, I get it. I need you to be doing these things. You can't do there because your mind's not there or your heart's not there because you're wrestling with things. I mean, everything just, like I said, everything comes up. I just live it all the time. So we had an employee, got hit with this huge expense, won't go into the details, was fixing to get absolutely hammered. We were able to front those dollars to get him out of that, which builds loyalty because we care about the fact he's doing. And we're just going to take it out a little bit of a time for each paycheck, not enough to cripple him. We're not trying to pay it back in two paychecks. We had another person. I mean, we have several people that have special needs kids. And so they're like, hey, I'll try to do it at lunch. But if I'm like, look, you got to take care of family. You know, if my operations is going to put such stress that somebody with special needs or has elderly parents, if they can't get away from the operation, if I don't build enough depth within the operation that I can't let people go take care of things that matter to them, then I'm not doing a very good job or I need to come up with a different strategy. So I tell people, look, you need to take care of you right now. You heard about the big mass shooting. Mm-hmm. The woman that was killed, was shot in the head, was the sister-in-law of somebody who works for me.
Oh, man.
He came in Monday morning and he said, Michael, I don't think I'll need more than a couple of days. I need some time. I was like, man, take all the time you need.
Yeah, no doubt.
Right now, your struggle, your pain, your all of that, that's the priority. We will continue, excuse me, we will continue to do what we do. You go take care of you. Let us know how we can help if you have needs. And you come back when you're ready to come back. And so that was be an example of just elevating the needs of others and showing that so that when they do come back and so they've had that experience, if I had to get tough and say, no, I need you to stay late. We've mm-hmm. got to get this done. This is why. It builds loyalty and it builds trust and all those things that the article said.
Yeah, and I think something too, because you are in the people serving business, people pleasing business, it's important to remember that we all respond and react to things differently. I can't quite understand why someone would need 3 days of bereavement when they lose their dog. But that's me.
But I
kind of now understand now that I've got a dog that's a good friend of mine. I kind of understand where that comes from. So, I mean, everyone's got a different thing. Just because we're all going through it doesn't mean different things to different people, for sure. The last thing, and I'll be honest with you, I cut the page off, so I'm not sure what it says. So I'm going to let you take this last one, which is anchor leadership. And I'm going to let you take it wherever you want to go with it.
Okay. When I saw that, the very first thing that I think about is if you are an effective leader, and that could be in the home, it could be in the business, it could be in a club, any group of people, if you take leadership, if you are somebody who is rooted in steadiness, you're steadfast, if you are reliable, if you, again, not perfect, but if people know, you know what, and I think about this because I'm the president-elect of our Rotary Club. So last year, as the president-elect nominee, they do it 2 years in advance. I had to get all the speakers for every week for a year. Now I'm the president-elect, and I'm over our major fundraiser. And the next year, I'll serve as president. And I thought about that, you know, well, what if, you know, something comes up in my life or I don't want to lose enthusiasm or whatever. But now I've got, you know, 35, 40 people that are counting on me to be there every week, do that. And it's the same thing within an organization. I think lots of times, if there's a change, now if I walked around with my hair on fire, then people would say, oh, I just don't feel confident about work. Am I going to lose my job? Is it going? But even with the government cuts, I tried to project that, look, we're going to be fine. You know, we're going to be fine. Don't worry about it. Your job's not in danger. Are there things we have to deal with as a result? Are there going to be some changes? Yeah, we're going to have to go through that. But take losing your job off the table.
Yeah.
And so let's operate in it. And I think that anchor leadership, at least for me, that's how I identify with it and relate to it, provides that kind of environment to where you want to be. Now, I will tell you this as well. If you're that person, everybody needs an outlet. Everybody's got their own fears, struggles, challenges, but you don't want to live that out in front of people who need you to be the oak tree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to live that, whether it's a pastor, a friend group, accountability partner, whatever it is, you want to live that.
Indeed.
Outside of your organization. Yeah.
Great stuff, my man. HAFB, hashtag that on everything we do here. Mission Mind, keep your mind your mission. Your mission, your mind. The CEO of the Heart of Alabama Food Bank, Michael Coleman. We do another show that is specific to what you do down there in the beautiful city of Montgomery called Bite by Bite. What are we going to be talking about next?
Yeah, we're going to talk about organizational change, and it's a you know, we serve the 34 counties, but we have four additional food banks. They're called affiliated food banks that are contracted with us that help us cover those 34.
Okay.
And it's just so funny. One change at the top at Feeding America filters through us, filters through that. And it's just it really comes to life how difficult change is for individuals.
All right, we'll get into it next. Continue to listen up here. And, of course, if you miss any of the shows, go to wherever you get your favorite podcast. We're available on every major industry, including Audacity now. We're everywhere, 1,000 listeners every single week. Thanks to everyone. Thank you, Michael. We will talk to you next here on Bite by Bite on Tony Curry Radio. Thank you, my man.
Enjoyed it, my friend.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.